Rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. God save the state of Texas.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court is very pleased to be here at St. Mary's University School of Law. Back in the late 1990s, the Constitution was amended that permitted the court to sit outside of Austin. And since then, the court has about twice a year gone to law schools and communities around the state. And when we do, the welcome has always been fantastic. But nowhere better than here at St. Mary's. The dean and the staff, the professors, all of you students have given us a very warm welcome, and we're looking forward to talking to you after these arguments are concluded. This is a homecoming of sorts for one of your alumni, Paul Green, who was born right here in San Antonio and graduated from St. Mary's Law School. And for me, because I grew up about 4 or 5 miles from here near Lackland Air Force Base, so it's always good to come back home. We hope that you will hear some very excellent arguments. The cases are quite interesting. This is a process where the court is engaged in a real dialogue with counsel and with our colleagues to try to get to the right result. After these arguments are concluded, the court will meet and conference on these cases, come up with a preliminary vote to see whether a majority has coalesced and whether there's going to be a dissent or concurrence, and then get to the process of drafting the opinions. So it's a great process. It's dynamic. The court is never of one mind on any case. There's always comments from each of us that contribute to the outcome. So we're looking forward to all of these. This morning we have three arguments on our docket, and they're being recorded. I want to give a special thank you to Marty Perez, who is right here. Marty and St. Mary's has been responsible for broadcasting all of our arguments over the internet. St. Mary's was very generous with the equipment and outfitting our court in Austin, and Marty has come and been with us each argument since March of 2007, and were it not for Marty and this law school, we wouldn't be broadcasting live as we are. Now, even as we go on the road, we have a remote broadcasting ability, and Marty is responsible for putting that together for us, too. So. We have three arguments this morning, and in the order of their appearance, they are docket number 08-1049, the University of Texas at El Paso versus Alfredo Herrera from El Paso County and the 8th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 090446, Debbie Stockton as parent and next friend of William Stockton, a minor, versus Howard A. Offenbach, M.D., from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 090481, Susan Combs, Comptroller of Public Accounts of the State of Texas, and Greg Abbott, Attorney General of the State of Texas, versus Texas Entertainment Association, Inc., and CarPod, Inc., from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. Each argument has been allotted 20 minutes per side. We will take a brief recess between each of the arguments so that other students can come, and I know some of you students have other classes to attend. The broadcast is going to be live on the internet, but They will also be archived on our court's website and on the St. Mary's University School of Law website, so you can watch those at your leisure. The court is now ready to hear argument in 081049, the University of Texas at El Paso versus Alfredo Herrera.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The United States Supreme Court has made clear that congressional legislation may validly abrogate the state's immunity from private suits only when the record establishes that Congress, first, has identified a widespread pattern of unconstitutional discrimination by the states, and second, that it has tailored its legislation to address that unconstitutional conduct. As nine federal circuit courts have already correctly concluded, that test is not met with regard to the self-care provision of the FMLA. The record underlying the act reveals that Congress failed to identify any pattern of unconstitutional discrimination by the states with regard to personal medical leave policies. And absent such findings, the substantive requirements of the self-care provision, mandating that state employees receive at least 12 weeks of personal medical leave per year, cannot be construed as a congruent and proportional response to unconstitutional conduct on the part of the states. For these reasons, the overwhelming majority of federal and state appellate courts that have considered this question have concluded that the self-care provision does not validly abrogate state sovereign immunity. We urge that this court do the same. Now, a useful starting point for this analysis is to review the limits on this congressional power of abrogation. As the United States Supreme Court said in Alden versus Maine, the state's immunity from suit was a fundamental aspect of sovereignty enjoyed by the states before the ratification of the Constitution and retained by them to this day. And as the court stated in that opinion, quote, the generation that designed and adopted our federal system considered immunity from private suits central to the state's sovereign dignity. It is for that reason that Congress has limits on its power to abrogate. For example, we know from Seminole Tribe and related Supreme Court cases that except in limited circumstances under bankruptcy proceedings, Congress may not use its Article I power to abrogate the state's immunity. We also know, however, that Congress does have power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to abrogate state immunity in order to enforce the guarantees of Section 1. And that power is broad, but it has limits. And those limits were defined by the Supreme Court in the City of Burney case and its progeny. And this is the so-called congruence and proportionality test. And that test is designed to ensure that when Congress enacts this type of legislation, it is not redefining the meaning of the rights or defining what the substance of the rights are under the 14th Amendment, because that is the duty of the court, not Congress.
And if we agree with all that, how does the waiver issue come into effect here?
The waiver issue under state law, yep. Justice Medina. We believe the waiver argument made by Mr. Herrera has no basis in this court's precedent or in the statutory authority from the Texas legislature. This court has consistently said that only the Texas legislature has the authority to waive by resolution or by statute the state's immunity. And Mr. Herrera's theory is that UTEP has the authority to declare its immunity waived at any time that it wants. That's directly contradicted by this court's case, numerous cases of this court.
Well, your view is a governmental unit can never waive its own immunity by conduct.
It cannot waive its own immunity, Justice Willett, by declaration. There have been limited instances, for example, in the Riata case, where it wasn't a declaration. It was the fact that a government entity actually entered litigation and made affirmative claims. That's entirely different from what happened in this case. There's no dispute that in this case, UTEP has not made any affirmative claims. So Mr. Herrera's invite this court to make a revolutionary change in its jurisprudence in saying that any state entity is entitled at any time to waive its immunity for anything it likes. And that would substantially infringe on the legislature's authority over the FISC.
Is it entitled to bargain, if you will, with its employees in a condition of employment as you comply with our handbook and our rules, and in return, you have the right to sue, or so they're negotiating for. not just a simple statement, you can sue us, but it is, in fact, sort of part of the bargain, if you will.
Well, Justice Guzman, that particular scenario, to start with, is not what's happening here. In other words, this isn't even a situation where there's a contract between Mr. Herrera and UTEP. There's no bargain to start with. Again, it's undisputed that he was an at-will employee, and this was a statement in a handbook that we're saying, to the extent it attempts to waive immunity for self-care leave, is not even authorized.
He's an at-will employee whose conditions of employment include complying with policy.
That's correct. He is required to meet the policies and procedures in the handbook. However, there is no contract between Mr. Herrera and the university, and I would add that in a similar situation, the Houston Court of Appeals dealt with in Slade versus Texas Southern, you had a university president who was fired for financial misconduct and said, well, that's a breach of my contract, and that court noted that with regard to, this court's well aware of its waiver by conduct jurisprudence, the Houston court said this court has never recognized a waiver by conduct exemption. And this court, in a series of cases like I.D. Davey and Pelzel and Castaneda, has repeatedly looked at that issue and said, we're not going to recognize a waiver by conduct, even in cases where there is no doubt that there was a binding contract. This case does not even rise to that level.
Can you direct your attention for a minute to the self-care provision and talk a little bit about Congress's purpose in enacting?
Certainly, Justice O'Neill. Our position is that the primary motivation that Congress had in passing the self-care provision was twofold. Primarily, it was designed to address the economic dislocation to families and to workers who suffer temporary disability, and secondarily, to address discrimination suffered by those workers. For example, people who suffer from cancer or heart disease or any type of illness that could keep them out of work.
Or pregnancy. And wasn't one of the purposes behind the self-care provision to eliminate disparity among employers in treating sick leave?
You're correct, Justice O'Neill, that pregnancy, disability associated with pregnancy is something that's covered under the Act. But there is not a reason to believe that the pregnancy disability was an overwhelming consideration. It was one of the many illnesses that Congress covered under the Act. In fact, if you look at the Senate report, this is 103-3, it's cited in our briefing and I believe the other side's briefing. Congress listed 13 separate conditions. It included pregnancy disability, but it included, as I've noted, cancer, it included stroke, it included pneumonia, it included all kinds of ailments suffered by employees of both sexes. And it's important to note that the evidence before Congress, and again, this is in another one of the reports that's actually cited at page 18 of our brief, said that recent studies indicate, I'm quoting, that men and women are out on medical leave approximately equally. Men workers experience an average of 4.9 days of work loss due to illness or injury, while women workers experience 5.1 days per year. And importantly, the next sentence we think is crucially important. Same report says the evidence also suggests that the incidence of serious medical conditions that would be covered by medical leave under the bill is virtually the same for men and women. Employers will find that women and men will take medical leave with equal frequency.
But pregnancy disability was covered separately before the self-care provision was enacted, right?
Was covered separately.
I mean, it wasn't included within the Family Leave Act.
That's correct. Pregnancy disability would be covered by self-care, whereas caring for newborn children is covered by, for example, there are specific provisions in the Act to provide for the care of newborns.
But wasn't it enough that Congress articulated that one of the reasons for folding this into the self-care provision was to eliminate disparity in the workforce? Why can't we give that consideration?
Your Honor, you certainly can give it consideration as something that may have been a motivation with regard to the purpose of the Act, but I would say to you that I think it was not at all the primary motivation. And let me give you another quote from a Senate report. The Senate report
is that the standard, that it has to be the primary motivation, or can a motivation suffice under the 14th Amendment for to waive a state's immunity? What's the standard?
Well, the standard would be that the court would have to, in terms of purpose, to the extent that the court evaluated the purpose as addressing, in part, gender discrimination, it's a factor that the court would have to take into account. But let me state this, Mr. Chief Justice. even if this court were to determine that, this act was, this provision, I'm sorry, was solely directed at self-care leave, the answer in this case would remain the same, because as nine federal courts of appeals and virtually every state appellate court that have looked at this act have said, there is, Congress failed to identify any pattern of unconstitutional state discrimination, both with regard to gender discrimination and with regard to disability. It's simply not there. And I'd like to give you, then Judge Alito, with regard to gender discrimination, put this point aptly in his opinion for the Third Circuit in Chittister, when he said, notably absent is any finding concerning the existence, much less the prevalence, in public employment of personal sick leave practices that amounted to intentional gender discrimination in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Moreover, even if there were relevant findings or evidence, the FMLA provisions at issue here would not be congruent or proportional. There are, we've cited them in our brief, there are numerous quotes like that from the various circuits. The Utah Supreme Court, I would add, reached a similar conclusion when it said Congress adduced no evidence of a pattern of discrimination on the part of the states regarding leave for personal medical reasons. They went on to say, having failed to establish the required relationship between the self-care provision and prevention of gender discrimination, and also having failed to identify a widespread pattern of state discrimination against the disabled.
Well, the Court of Appeals goes at great length into the context of the FMLA passage, including history of gender discrimination 30 years after the passage of Title VII. So why is that not enough of a record for this?
Mr. Chief Justice, we would submit that perhaps the best indication that there isn't really there wasn't really any record before Congress of unconstitutional discrimination by the states is to look at what the Court of Appeals relied upon in its opinion. Because when you read that opinion, you'll see that it essentially relies on two items, neither of which prove that point. The first item that the Court of Appeals relied upon is the discussion in the Hibbs case of pages 730 through 732 of the Hibbs opinion about evidence regarding state maternity and paternity leave policies. All of the evidence that is discussed in Hibbs does not have anything to do with the self-care leave provision. It has to do with the other provisions of the FMLA regarding family care and child care leave. So the court's reliance on that simply is irrelevant to the self-care leave provision.
But the court said there was a stereotype that even under that provision, the stereotype was that more women took advantage of that provision.
You mean with regard to a stereotype with regard to self-care?
No, with regard to family leave.
Yes, and there's no doubt that with regard to family leave, the Supreme Court's opinion makes clear that not only was there a stereotype, but critically, Justice O'Neill, in Hibbs, the Supreme Court goes through actual evidence, materials and evidence of what they say are discriminatory state policies with regard to maternity and paternity leave. That is conspicuously missing regarding the self-care leave provision.
But I thought that what the Court of Appeals keyed off on was that the self-care provision was partially intended to remedy that stereotype in the family care provision.
I didn't read the court's opinion to say that, but if it did, I think it would have been misguided. And the reason is that to the extent that the purpose being attributed to the self-care provision is to care for other family members or to care for children, that wouldn't make a lot of sense because there are other provisions of the FMLA that already provide for that in A, B, and C. Self-care leave provision is meant to address a different problem. And I would note that in addition to the reference to Hibbs, the only other reference the Court of Appeals makes is to the one sentence of the testimony of one witness at a 1987 hearing, Ms. Montez. Mind you, this is in the context of a congressional history that the court itself acknowledges goes back 8 years. And we've looked at this. We're talking about 18 House and Senate reports, 11 hearings before committees and subcommittees of Congress, and substantial floor debate. And what the Court of Appeals came up with was one sentence from one witness at a hearing in 1987. And that one sentence, by the way, is what's cited in Hibbs, Ms. Montes' testimony. In fact, even that single sentence does not actually reflect the substance of Ms. Montes' testimony.
Assuming, just for argument, that we disagree with you, that we believe gender bias, combating gender bias, was the principal motivation here. What congressional remedy would be congruent, would be proportional to achieving that goal?
Well, Justice Willett, I'm afraid the short answer is we don't know based on this record, because simply having a purpose of meeting gender bias is insufficient. What you'd have to look at is if Congress had actually put together a pattern of unconstitutional state conduct, then you would look at how is the remedy meeting that unconstitutional state conduct that's been identified. Simply saying there's a purpose, which is part of what the lower court is saying, doesn't get you there. And in fact, the lower court obviously recognized that there was a problem with the evidence, because the lower court made it a point of saying we're not persuaded that in order to uphold the self-care provision, it's necessary to have a congressional record replete with evidence showing a pattern of gender-based discrimination. But that is directly contrary to Supreme Court case after Supreme Court case, which say that Congress may only use its Section 5 power when it has identified specific conduct by the states transgressing the 14th Amendment. If I can briefly quote the Garrett case. The Garrett case says, this is U.S. Supreme Court, says, quote, Congress is the final authority as to desirable public policy. But in order to authorize private individuals to recover money damages against the states, there must be a pattern of discrimination by the states which violates the 14th Amendment. And the remedy imposed by Congress must be congruent and proportional to the targeted violation. That simply isn't met here.
Additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Jordan. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, good morning. The Family and Medical Leave Act is part of a larger legislative framework that's designed to remedy a persistent history of gender discrimination at work and to dismantle gender-based barriers to the hiring and the retention and the promotion of women in the workplace, including gender discrimination by the states in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Are the
They are wrong. And I think there are four big reasons and one smaller reason why they're wrong. And let me just, I guess I'll list the reasons first before going into detail. I guess I would be remiss if I didn't point out at first that even prior to Hibbs, eight federal circuits had erroneously held that Congress did not validly abrogate immunity with respect to the Family Care Clause of the FMLA. So we know the Supreme Court said that part was wrong. I think the major flaws in the opinions going the other way are, first of all, a failure by the courts to recognize that the statute was designed to combat gender discrimination, and therefore a failure to apply the heightened standard of review that exists when courts are reviewing decisions by the states that classify employees on the basis of gender, as opposed to on the basis of age or disability, where only a rational basis review might apply. Secondly, I think the courts overemphasize the congressional record to determine whether there is a pattern of unconstitutional action by the states, as opposed to the historical record. Third, I think the
Let me ask you about that. Isn't it important what they find? Congress might not believe the historical record.
It is important what they find, but what they find need not be based only on the congressional record. We can view Congress's findings, and in fact are required to view Congress's findings, through the lens of the teachings of history, specifically the historical record as recognized by the courts of gender discrimination by the states.
Why does gender discrimination get a different analysis than age discrimination?
Constitutionally, states may classify employees on the basis of age, and their decision to do so is subject to review only under a rational basis standard. That is, their states' decisions will be upheld if there's a rational basis for the classifications they've made. By contrast, because of the existing history of gender discrimination in this country, courts subject gender classifications by states and local governments to a heightened standard of review. That standard of review requires the state to show that the classification serves important governmental objectives and that the discriminatory means employed by the state are substantially related to the achievement of those objectives.
Can you give me a concrete example of how the self-care provision combats gender discrimination?
Sure. First of all, pregnancy disability leave is self-care. Employers deciding to whether to hire employees, specifically if they're looking to a potential employee who's a married woman of childbearing age, may assume and the course recognize are likely to presume that those women are likely to take leave for pregnancy-related reasons. And therefore, based on that presumption, even if it's not a valid presumption, but based on the presumption that a woman will take more personal disability leave for self-care, employers are likelier to hire a male employee.
How is the disability that arises from the postpartum episode different from another type of disability, such that gender discrimination would be the rationale for Section D?
Because women get pregnant and men don't. I mean, that's
in I guess contemporary times, there are many men who are taking advantage of the provisions to take time off to be with.
Sure, and I think we need to distinguish between leave for medical purposes associated with pregnancy, which is self-care leave, and leave to care for newborns, which is family care leave.
Is self-care leave limited to medical reasons associated with pregnancy?
No. And that is Congress recognized in its stating the purposes of the statute and its own findings that employment standards, this is in Section 2601A6 of the statute, employment standards that apply to one gender only have a serious potential for encouraging employers to discriminate against employees and applicants for employment who are of that gender. So Congress could have enacted a self-care statute that covered only pregnancy disability leave. And of course that would apply only to women who are pregnant and need leave for medical reasons associated with their pregnancy.
And are those medical reasons different than just, I guess, the common recovery period associated? That
sure.
Different?
Sure. I mean, it includes medical disability, medical inability to perform the duties of a position during the pregnancy and not just after the child is born. So, morning sickness, back pain, those sorts of things can cause an employee to become physically unable to perform the duties of a position.
You could have that where you're not morning sickness, but the back pain and other types of illnesses.
Whether you're a woman or a man, sure. And the congressional record, as opposing counsel pointed out, indicates that women and men take personal medical leave approximately in equal numbers. There's not a great difference between the numbers of days that men and women are out of work, but employers presume that women, particularly married women of a certain age, are likely to need leave if they become pregnant, or are likely to become pregnant and need to take that leave. And so they're likelier to hire, promote, or retain men than women based on that presumption.
Is that part of the congressional record?
It's discussed in the Hibbs opinion, Your Honor, that based on both the congressional record and the historical record, that the act is designed to prevent hiring decisions based on these sorts of presumptions.
Why wouldn't employer reluctance to hire women, if anything, be magnified or exacerbated by requiring employers to then give women 12 weeks of leave? I mean, why wouldn't the reluctance be that much more enhanced if the cost of giving that leave goes up?
Because the statute requires the employers to give the leave to everyone, men or women. And that was part of Congress's finding, that we can't just grant pregnancy leave because that would encourage employers to discriminate against women. That's why we give leave to everyone. Now it's unpaid leave. So the cost of giving the leave is, certainly there is a cost, but it's not an inordinate cost to employers. But Congress, in its judgment, decided that it would help prevent discrimination against female applicants and female employees if all employees were entitled to take leave, up to 12 weeks of leave for medical reasons.
Counsel, Justice Green pointed out that 9 federal circuit courts have ruled contrary to your position. You were going through the major flaws in those opinions. Your second point was that those federal courts of appeals, you believe, overemphasize the congressional as opposed to the historical record.
That's correct.
Are you suggesting that you don't think the congressional record is sufficient to support your position, or do you think it is? And what's the difference, significant differences between the congressional and historical record?
Well, I think that the congressional record cannot be viewed in isolation. And I think that we have a tendency, perhaps, as appellate lawyers, to look first to the paper record to see if it supports the decision that was made. But that's not the exclusive source for deciding whether Congress had the power to act under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to remedy a pattern of discrimination by the states. In City of Burney, even the court wrote that judicial deference, in most cases, is based not on the state of the legislative record Congress compiles, but on due regard for the decision of the body constitutionally appointed to decide. And therefore, as a general matter, it's for Congress to determine the method by which it will reach a decision. That language is echoed in the Florida prepaid post-secondary education case, where the court flat out said lack of support in the legislative record is not determinative. And that's why Hibbs, in its analysis, didn't begin with the congressional record, but began with the historical record of discrimination by the states. It pointed out that there is a pervasive history of gender discrimination.
But if there were a better congressional record, then a court would better be able to evaluate whether the act ameliorates the problem, right? Because there are hearings, there would be economists who would come in and testify, labor experts, to say this self-care provision will indeed reduce discrimination against women. But we don't find that here. We don't find that in that context. Evaluate that.
Of course, the larger the congressional record, the easier it is to tell that Congress was aiming to remedy or deter unconstitutional behavior, and whether or not its chosen remedy is proportional and congruent to the unconstitutional behavior found. But again, that's not the only source of information we have to look at. And if we look at other gender discrimination statutes like Title VII, Title VII, as proposed, was intended to remedy race discrimination. Gender discrimination was thrown in as an afterthought and really as part of an attempt to defeat Title VII.
But the question is, how do we know that this, even assuming that this was intended to combat gender discrimination, how do we know without a record whether this does that? You know, there ought to be hearings, it seems to me. There ought to be testimony, economists, some record to show that this act, that this provision will actually cure that problem.
Certainly, for any piece of legislation you can imagine, the more congressional hearings we have,
outside the record, what studies are there that show that this provision combats gender discrimination? What is the court to look to?
Well, again, Judge, I think I can only point you to, the existing historical record, the court's recognition that the pattern of discrimination is based on certain presumptions about the role of men and women in the workplace, including presumptions about leave that may be taken by women as opposed to leave that may be taken by men.
But
and Congress's findings.
To return to your example, though, the Fifth Circuit struggled with it because it didn't make any logical sense. Historical record aside, that might help, but just logically, if you're reluctant to hire women because you're afraid they're going to get pregnant, requiring you to give them time off if they get pregnant doesn't make you less reluctant to hire them. So the Fifth Circuit said, well, how could this possibly further to fight against gender discrimination?
Well, it does if you think that men are not likely to take time off and women are. And what the Hibbs Court said is that by imposing an across-the-board entitlement to 12 weeks of leave, you're less likely, employers are less likely to base their hiring decisions on the presumption that only the women will take the leave.
Mobs, if we disagree with you in your analysis on these other nine circuits, can you still prevail on this waiver issue?
I think so. The UTEP's employee handbook, which, you know, Mr. Hura's employment relationship with UTEP is a contractual relationship, even if it's at-will employment. And UTEP's employee handbook advises employees that that they have FMLA rights and that an eligible employee may bring a civil action against an employer for a violation of the act. It's true that the majority of this course's jurisprudence states that sovereign immunity can only be waived by the legislature, but there are exceptions. And one of those exceptions in the Riata case was that a state can waive its immunity by going into court. Well, I think most...
Well, not going into court. By seeking
court
affirmative relief.
By seeking affirmative relief in court.
Obviously, the state gets sued a lot as a defendant and goes into court for that purpose, but that's not a waiver.
Sure.
Actually, we didn't say it waived it. We said it was abrogated. It just did not have it anymore. It made a decision, and once it made that decision, the courts unity at that point.
And the question that Mr. Herrera would pose is, how is that decision to give up your immunity by filing a suit different from the considered decision to give up your immunity as part of a contract of employment?
Can we cover that in Took, though, where we said even if the city charter, if the city had a charter saying we can sue and people can sue us, that doesn't count?
Well, I think this court held that the language sue and be sued by itself is not sufficient to waive immunity. Not that the city would not have the power to waive its immunity by saying something more specific like a citizen may bring a civil action against the city.
You said Mr. Herrera's employment was contractual even though it was at will.
Sure. An employment relationship is a contractual relationship. Even in that will.
Even in the absence of a contract?
Well, it is a contract. I mean, a verbal...
At will employment is contractual?
It is a contractual.
Even though either party at any time for any reason, good or bad, can walk away?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's an exchange of benefits, an exchange of work for salary or wages, and it's an agreed relationship with a mutual exchange of consideration. It's a contractual relationship. It's terminable at will by either party. And UTEP, of course, could modify the terms of Mr. Herrera's employment contract by changing its manual, or the terms of its contract with all of its employees by changing its manual to say, we can violate the FMLA, but you can't sue us if we do.
Counsel, does your argument mean that every subdivision of the state, every local governmental entity, every county entity, every city entity, water district, et cetera, and the contracts it enters with with private entities can waive immunity, so that there are thousands or hundreds of thousands of possible waivers out there in contracts? Is that where your argument takes us,
if they
logically?
Yes. If they do so explicitly, I see no reason why a governmental entity cannot enter into a contract saying we're waiving our immunity from suit on this contract. And that's a decision that the governmental entity can make, you know, in the judgment of its board of directors.
That would be a major change in what we've seen with litigation with the state in the past, wouldn't it?
Well,
and in our jurisprudence.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I mean, your cases...
Where's the case that says that?
Your cases do not involve explicit waivers by governmental entities of the right to sue them on a contract.
But you would agree that we've never held what you've just said.
I would agree with that, yes.
Let me take you back to the record questions. When I was asking about the extent of the congressional versus the historical record, and the chief put a finer point on it, asking about when the court's trying to figure what the purpose was of an act and whether there's congruence with the action, the purpose of the harm to be addressed, whether the act congruently or appropriately addresses that harm.
Yes.
The congressional record tells us exactly what was brought up, at least in the Congress. Maybe not everybody considered it, but it's in the record. And then there's historical documents, studies, state actions, articles, newspaper reports that are out there that may be beyond the congressional record. Do we assume that Congress knew all of that information, some of it? Where's the dividing line in determining how much of what you call the historical record we should presume Congress knew and acted on in FMLA provisions?
I haven't seen a court articulate a dividing line like that. But since, you know, 1966 in South Carolina versus Katzenbach and reiterated by the Supreme Court in Burney and reiterated again in 2004 in Tennessee versus Lane, the court has said that whether a statute validly enforces constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment is a question that must be judged with reference to the historical experience that it reflects. And that's why Hibbs began its analysis not with the congressional record, but with the historical record of discrimination.
I grant you that point. My question is, how much of what you call the historical record should we presume Congress knew and looked at?
And I don't know that there's an answer to that in the jurisprudence. I think that if there's a series of cases from the Supreme Court, a series of cases from federal appellate courts involving discrimination by state employers, then that's something you can presume the Congress is aware of.
Well, but saying that you start with the historical record, all that means is that the Congress can't make it up. It has to have facts to support its findings. It doesn't mean that if there is a record, it has to believe it. Congress can make another determination.
But Congress did believe it. And we know that because it said so in stating the purposes of the Act in Section 2601B. 2601A has the congressional findings. Section 2601B has the congressional purposes, including in its purposes are to entitle employees to take reasonable leave for medical reasons. In Section 2601B4, to accomplish that purpose and other purposes of the Act in a manner that consistent with the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment minimizes the potential for employment discrimination on the basis of sex by ensuring generally that leave is available for eligible medical reasons, including pregnancy-related disability, on a gender-neutral basis. And I see that my time has expired.
Continue. You can finish your thought.
And subsection B5 of the statute, which goes on to state that another purpose of the Act is to promote the goal of equal employment opportunity for women and men pursuant to such clause that is the Equal Protection Clause.
Further questions? Thank you,
thank
counsel.
I have just a couple of points to make. The first is that it was stated that it is appellate lawyers that are looking to want to look to the congressional record. And the fact is that this is not a standard that is created by lawyers. This is the United States Supreme Court's standard that it has stated repeatedly in the cases in City of Burney. The court has repeatedly said Congress must identify a pattern of unconstitutional state conduct. And again, that has not been met here. But second, I'd like to talk a little bit about this notion of purpose. I think this goes partially your questions, Justice Hecht, and partially yours, Justice Guzman, which is, to the extent that it is being asserted or was asserted by the Court of Appeals, that this statute was designed to address a stereotype that women take more leave than men, regardless of even if they were provided equal leave. As Justice Hecht noted, it's hard to see how the self-care provision would help in that circumstance, because presumably that stereotype assumes that even provided equal leave, women would take more leave than men, and an employer who believed that would still discriminate. But more to the point, the record before Congress established precisely the opposite. The record before Congress, as I noted earlier, stated that the indications were men and women took leave equally, and indeed that the expectation under the FMLA was that they would take leave equally. Now, this question of the fact that pregnancy disability is covered by the Act is notable, because when the Seventh Circuit considered this question in the Toler versus Wisconsin Department of Corrections case, in the argument, which the court can hear, I would urge the court to listen to if it wants, in that argument, Judge Wood and Judge Posner were asking questions about this notion of pregnancy disability versus all the other types of illnesses that are covered by the Act. And the notion that they had was it would sort of be like the tail wagging the dog if you were to say that this was really all about pregnancy disability, when in fact the vast majority of people who are going to be taking time off are not going to be taking it off for pregnancy disability leave. The cases that are cited in the briefs and in the lower court opinion bear that out for what it's worth. Counting the nine circuit opinions and the other court opinions that are cited in the briefs, there are 25 court opinions here that have to do with the self-care leave provision, 25. One of those cases, One concerns pregnancy disability leave.
Out of those circuit opinions that are cited in the briefs, how many cases were presented to the Supreme Court by a cert petition? Do you know?
I'm not sure how many, Your Honor. I'm not sure how many of the circuit have gone up on a cert petition.
I mean, you would think that if they got it very wrong, then the court would take one of those nine up if they were cert petitions filed. And conversely, if we were to affirm the Court of Appeals, you two may need a ticket to D.C., don't you think?
Well, Your Honor, I believe my argument to the Supreme Court would be, in my brief in opposition, would be the argument I'm making today, which is, in fact, there isn't really a meaningful split here. And it goes to the reason you just stated, Mr. Chief Justice. There's not a reason for the Supreme Court to examine this question right now because the courts are substantially unified. The only opinions out there are pretty much outliers. There's an unpublished Fourth Circuit opinion, the Montgomery case, with no analysis whatsoever. There's a magistrate judge's opinion from the Western District of New York with no analysis whatsoever. All of the principal opinions that go through analysis of this reach the result that we're talking about.
Justice O'Neill.
You mentioned that the handbook cannot waive immunity because UTEP cannot decide to waive immunity. You have to go to the legislature. What would that look like? How would UTEP go to the legislature for that sort of waiver as a practical matter? Would they have to run the handbook by the legislature and say, we want to allow these types of claims?
I would presume, Justice O'Neill, that they would need to go to the legislature to see if the legislature would not create something that I think would apply beyond UTEP, that would apply to state agencies generally, that would say you can make self-care leave claims. It's worth noting, Justice O'Neill, that there is a companion Texas statute to the FMLA. It's at Government Code 661.912 that says state employees get leave according to the FMLA. Presumably, UTEP or other state agencies could go to legislature and say, can you add a provision onto that that says they also get to sue under the FMLA? That, of course, has not happened here. That's a decision for the legislature.
Of the nine federal courts of appeal that go your way, what is the division?
Importantly, there were five courts of appeals, federal courts of appeals, that decided this question before Hibbs and said that the self-care provision did not. The self-care provision did not waive immunity. Since Hibbs, there are seven federal courts of appeals that have decided that or reaffirmed that the self-care provision does not abrogate state sovereign immunity. And I believe all of the state opinions we rely on are all post-Hibbs. So all of those courts have said Hibbs does not control with regard to self-care leave provision.
Are there further questions? Thank you, Mr. Jordan. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right. Care to leave, would you please?